Once upon a time, we say to the child, storytellers, we are lords of time, making it come to us and stand still, while we charm the child with a tale that is true or imagined. Once upon a time. But a wild Welsh poet named Dylan Thomas knew something else. Singing about how quickly childhood passes, in a beautiful poem, he made a subtle change in that old beginning and gave us a deeper truth. Once below a time, beneath it, under its dominion, not the lords of time, but its plaything, led by the hand from morning till evening, until, like obedient children, we have walked the short way from the happy innocence of childhood to the bittersweet wisdom of old age. Time, the element in which we live, divided by human minds for the regulation and convenience of human life, and so hard to define that students throw up their hands in despair, penetrating our language in so many ways that my unabridged dictionary lists under its primary heading alone 67 different meanings. But we won't survey them. We're going to consider time in more practical and familiar ways, and one of them is how differently we experience one segment of time from another segment which may be of identical duration. Let me give you a personal illustration. I am not a good shopper. I never want to go shopping unless I need something very specific. And even then, if the choices get too many and I'm spending very much time at it, I tend to grab the least offensive item just to escape. I confess this with regret, not with pride, because I learned a long time ago that most wives adore a husband who can shop in a leisurely, graceful manner, making pleasant small talk as he moves from store to store. I think mothers who wish to shape their sons into ideal husbands should teach them how to enjoy this kind of diversion, shopping with no definite aim in view except the joys of looking and pricing and making comparisons. I have heard Billy sigh enviously when other women were describing how their husbands helped them buy a dress or a coat, although when I mentioned this last week, she declared in a moment of sacrificial loyalty that she really preferred to shop alone. I was grateful to her for excusing my handicap, but I think the deep down truth is that she'd rather shop alone than witness my anguish. The fact is that 30 minutes in a store, drifting from one counter to another, is an eternity for me. I may happily jog 3 miles in the morning and do leg lifts on 3 different machines, but put me in a store and those legs fail me. My feet start to hurt and I want to lie down. Get me out of the store and I make a miraculous recovery, able to mow the lawn, rake leaves, play some active outdoor game, an hour or two seeming to pass for me in a matter of minutes. The point is that time is relative, something you know already from your own experience. Einstein once suggested this relativity by remarking that if a young man in love spends 2 hours with his sweetheart, it will seem like 5 minutes. But if he sits on top of a hot stove for 1 minute, it will seem like forever. I hate to bring it up, but think how short the movie seems and how long the sermon. But even that is not the aspect of time I'd like to talk about. There's another, which I've tried to suggest by the title, The Right Moment. There is a proverb which, if read in the Living Bible, is as clear as English words can make it. Being happy-go-lucky around a person whose heart is heavy is as bad as stealing his jacket in cold weather or rubbing salt into his wounds. In other words, the matter of timing. Not just whether one does what is right, but whether one has picked the right time to do it. Everything has its appointed hour. So goes that famous chapter in Ecclesiastes. There is a time to laugh and a time to cry, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time for silence and a time for speech. I can't remember any other lines from it, but I saw a children's poem once that said, "When I am crying, I don't want to be tickled. All a matter of timing." A Greek philosopher, about 300 years before Christ, wrote 30 satirical sketches called characters. And one of the characters is what he calls the unseasonable man, the unfortunate person with a faculty for choosing the wrong moment. And here are some of those moments, as Theophrastus described them all those centuries ago. The man who sings a serenade to his sweetheart when she has the flu. The man who, just after you have gone bail for somebody and had to pay up, comes with a request that you go bail for him. The man who, when you've just reached home after a long journey, invites you to come for a walk. Just after you've sold your house, he brings you a buyer who offers more. It sounds almost as if it were written yesterday. Some of you, I think, will remember Charles Coburn, a grand old actor who was asked the stock question one day in an interview. What does one need to get ahead in life? Brains, energy, education? He shook his head. Those things help, but there's something even more important: knowing the right moment. The moment to act or not to act, the moment to speak or to keep silent. On the stage, we call it timing, and I think it's the key in life as well. In your marriage, your work, your relationships with other people. One of my friends asked his wife one day which of his smaller failings annoyed her the most. She didn't hesitate a moment. She said, "Your tendency to wait until we're about to walk into a party before you tell me that my hair is mussed or that my dress doesn't look quite right. A matter of timing." Jesus understood it. "I have many things to say to you," he said to his followers, "but you cannot bear them now." Not now. Maybe later. That comment has always intrigued me. I wonder what he would have said to them if they had been ready. Who knows what we have missed? But it would have been wasted then, whatever it was, and he knew it. It was the wrong time. Not everybody is as sensitive as he was for picking the right times to say nothing at all. I remember as if it were last week, a day in a small town in Texas where Billy and I had gone for the funeral of her brother. The minister who had known the family for years was asked to come from out of town to speak. He felt the grief of Marion's family, and he recalled with sensitivity the happy times and the good qualities in Marion's life. But when he finished, and quite without an invitation to do so, the local preacher decided he should stand up and tack on an official coda. He knew neither the dead man nor the family. He had no feeling for the moment. It was simply that he thought it was the right time to preach about the doctrines of his church. I confess that I have never wanted more in all of my life to stuff a towel in a man's mouth. His timing was incredible. It left a long, bitter taste in the mouths of all of us. And I was equally surprised one day at a wedding. A close high school friend of Billy's was getting married to a fine-looking boy, and we had gone to Oklahoma City to express our love and support. Yvonne was a beautiful girl, as dewily fresh as brides are supposed to be in the most romantic of imaginations. Her young man looked you straight in the eye. The two of them had asked the minister of their church to perform the ceremony. And this is what he did. He went through the usual wedding vows and questions and comments, and then he set out on a 15 to 20 minute sermon, a very graphic sermon, believe me, on the evils of fornication. I think none of us could believe what we were hearing. And to this day, I cannot imagine what led him into such exquisitely hideous timing. In a moment of tenderness and trust, of optimism and affectionate hope, he chose to talk about lust and betrayal. It got darker in that church while he talked. I think the sun went off and hid behind a cloud while this unseasonable man rambled on about the degeneracy of the young. Totally out of sync. The worst of all possible timing. Now, I will admit that these two examples are spectacular, but they are ones I saw, and they confirm the biblical message: timing can be almost everything. Especially, one realizes in the kind of family life represented by so many people in this room. One small example. The one way we can help each other in the intimacy of family life is by calling attention to little imperfections. You need to stop rubbing your nose so often while you preach. You need to stop waving your hand so much when you talk to people. It detracts from the power of your words. Both good bits of advice to a husband and a wife, but both dangerous unless they are properly timed. Spoken, that is, when the recipient is up rather than down. Basking in a recent triumph rather than depressed by a recent failure. Catch me when the rooms in my psyche are desolate, and I'll call your slightest criticism nagging and resent it time it differently, and I may be grateful the rest of my life to someone who cared enough to tell me about a weakness no one else would mention. So, the right moment and the right use of it. Part of what Paul means when he says, make the best possible use of your time. I would really like to live by Emerson's advice. Write it on your heart that every day is the best day in the year. And I think all this applies in a special way to religion. We make no greater mistake than to tie religion into special hours and seasons, because when that defines religion, I'm in total agreement with William Temple, the brilliant Archbishop of Canterbury, who used to say to his people, God is not primarily interested in religion. He meant the set hours, the trappings of ritual, the special nomenclature. If religion is trapped in church, in buildings, by the calendar, instead of loose to work in school and workplace and on the playing fields, then it seems to me something totally alien to what Jesus talked about. And always, no matter where one is, the sensitivity to the right moment. I remember an old inscription I saw one day. I was roaming around some little villages near the center of England, and I'd been drawn to enter the chapel of a little village called Stanton Harold. As usual, I stepped quietly up and down the aisles, reading the inscriptions on the walls, and I saw this one. In the year 1653, it said, when all things sacred were throughout this nation either demolished or profaned, Sir Robert Shirley, Baronet, founded this church. Sir Robert Shirley, whose singular praise it is to have done the best things in the worst times. I'd like to have known Sir Robert, a man not to be defeated by time nor by the times, a man who thought he perceived the right moment and so acted and turned out to be right. I am helpless to tell you how to know things like this, what the right moment will be for speaking to your son, to your estranged friend, to the partner of your life who wonders what is wrong. But I can remind you to be thoughtfully watching for it. And I can speak to you my faith that if you do that, you will recognize the moment. In his name, who builds week by week the church in this place. Amen.